This is Carolyn Ward, January 9th, 2004. The Dark Feminine. Tape 1 of 2.
It is really wonderful to be back in the Northwest. It's a real thrill. And to look out and see the patches of snow on the ground is fabulous. It makes me very moved. So I want to talk to you tonight. I've got a lot to talk about, a lot of music, a lot of image. Whatever we don't get through with tonight, we'll get to tomorrow, and we'll add more to it, much more. This is a topic that's engaged me for really quite a long time, and I always do welcome the chance to talk about it. At the beginning, some 19 years ago, I knew only that I felt compelled to explore the figure of Mary Magdalene. Now I can say that for over 2,000 years, we've been really in the dark about something crucial to and found in each one of us, both men and women. And that's what I'm calling the dark feminine, or the part of the feminine that's been kept in the dark. The work involves a descent into a hidden tradition. It's told in the legends of many ancient gods and goddesses, and a journey that each of us can take in our own way. Over the years, I've found it reassuring and revealing and sometimes very challenging, so you can see how it is for you. Every time I work with the material, such as preparing for this weekend, much as I welcome the chance to talk about it, I also find that I'm required to make a new descent into it, changing, adding, getting new insights, and maybe a little bit like Inanna on her own journey to the underworld. Sometimes find myself impaled on that meat hook of my own anxieties and realizations and questions and so on. Each time, I find myself deeply affected all over again, and I never know in advance where that's going to be. I do know that it also means that I'm probably in touch with the right place within, and I think this is the nature of the journey into redeeming the dark feminine, and we don't undertake it lightly. Tonight, I'm going to be talking primarily about Mary Magdalene in Western biblical tradition. What's been quite obvious and what has not been obvious at all. It'll be amplified with slides and music, and then I'll be talking a bit about her much larger role in the Gnostic tradition, the ancient papyrus texts, and a bit about how she's related to the Black Madonnas and the ancient goddesses. We'll get much more into that part of it, the legend and so forth, tomorrow, a lot about the legendary, the Black Madonnas, the ancient dark goddesses, some clinical material, and much more time for discussion than I can allow tonight. I'm going to be kind of barreling through this, and I appreciate saving questions till the end and hope we have time. Now, you see me up here with a sheaf of notes. I'm a feeling type. I don't have a whole lot of access to linear thought except when I write, so I have to write it all down or I'm all over the place. I just try not to read too much, so bear with that. I think there's no better way to begin our immersion in this topic than with music and image. So first, it's going to be a piece of music. Have you all gotten the bibliography and discography that's over there? Well, it's there and available to you, so I'm not going to be giving the details of all the recordings. But this is the Maronite chant. It's sung by a Lebanese woman. The chant takes us back maybe as far as the 5th century of the Common Era. In this recording, it's sung in Arabic, but originally it would have been sung in a dialect of the Aramaic language called Syriac. And Syriac just happens to be the dialect that was spoken by Mary of Magdala and her friend, whom we have come to know as Jesus. The chant is sung in a traditional style with a verse and a refrain, and it's about the resurrection. And the words of the refrain are, "Mary, cease your weeping, Christ is risen." It's about 4.5 minutes long, and as with each piece of music, and I'll explain a little bit more about this later, the point is to see what it evokes in you. And you may want to make a note or two about it, and tomorrow hopefully we'll have time to discuss it. So here's a chant. I'm the lucky one because I'm up here and I get to kind of see responses and I see expressions on faces, about the nuance of that, and I see bodies moving. It really gets right into your body, doesn't it? Now we'll move to image. And the first one, let's see, can I get that? I don't know if I can. Oops. And the slide projector, I think this went off. Okay. Is it on? And we might, I don't know if any of these lights can be turned off. Yeah. Turn off the front ones. Yeah, great, great. This is Chartres Cathedral at sunset. The only way I've ever figured out how to describe Chartres to anybody is it reminds me of Rainier looming over Seattle. It's like that in the landscape. There are two black Madonnas here. This first one, is that focused? Okay. This first one is on the main, level of the cathedral. She's called Our Lady of the Pillar. And there are people there, ordinary people, often reverently touching or kissing the pillar on which she sits, deep in prayer or meditation or whatever it is. And downstairs in the crypt, which is the largest crypt in Christendom, is this black Madonna. She is a black Madonna, Our Lady Sous Terre, Notre Dame Sous Terre, Our Lady Under the Earth. The original of this was burned in the French Revolution, and so she's a copy, but you can't get to the crypt except on tour. And when I was there and tried to go, the tour was only in French, and the guide was really quite indifferent to this figure. So most people don't know very much about her. So there are two black Madonnas at this major, major spiritual center, Chartres Cathedral. And one of the major tour guides at Chartres not only doesn't talk about them, he was in San Francisco not long ago, and I had been on one of his tours at Chartres. And so I knew who he was and went up ahead of time, and he's very knowledgeable about the cathedral. And I said, and I'm going to give you a verbatim account of the conversation, including pauses. So I said, "And will you be speaking about the black Madonnas at Chartres?" "There are none." "There's a dirty one." "Well, some of the locals call it a black Madonna." End of conversation. So you've now seen the two black Madonnas that are not at Chartres. At Rocamadour in southwest France in the Dordogne region, I was very moved to see groups of pilgrims going up about somewhere like 200 stone steps on their knees, chanting a litany on each step. You have to have good knees for this one. In preparation for their visit to this black Madonna. Her chapel, which is dedicated to her alone, is in the midst of this great huge rock. The ceiling is the cave. She's only about 2 feet high, actually. And around in the chapel are clearly posted lists of her many, many miracles. Yet my French friend, who told me about Rocamadour and the pilgrims and the chanting, was not aware until I told him that there was a black Madonna there. At St. Victor's in Marseille, we walked into the church, and there was a figure of a black Madonna right inside the entrance, which is a pretty unusual placement in my experience, and so we were interested in it. But the man who was at the table selling cards came over and said, no, this one's just a replica. If you want to see the real thing, you have to go down in the crypt, and that would be €2, please. And but there in the crypt is this lovely figure. It's about this church, I think, dates from the 4th century, and you really feel it in that crypt. And her little chapel is right next to the chapel of Marie Madeleine, Mary Magdalene in French. So we can turn the slide projector off for a little bit now. So this chant and these images invite us to make this descent into this hidden tradition that I've been describing. It's a tradition that's been muffled and veiled and distorted and hidden in the dark and discounted or reduced to the dark and forbidden. But it's a tradition that's very much alive today and which is emerging into the light or being redeemed, which just means to be means being bought back. Some evocative words and images that come up over and over when you begin to look into this tradition, you've already begun to hear the idea of descent, caves, earths, wells, the underground, cult, which just means culture, occult, which means hidden, colors, the colors red and black, particularly as in Black Madonnas, the body, the heart, harlots, the great whore of Babylon in the Book of Revelation. She's the sun-moon woman who holds the golden cup. Intensity of experience up to and including miracles. Goddess figures such as Isis, Sophia, that Sophia is the Greek name, Sapiensi is the Latin name, Wisdom is the English name, and you'll hear them all in the course of this weekend. While we can't know what the prototype of the dark feminine is, we can discover some of her characteristics, that is the pattern of the archetype, by looking at any of her images, known culturally by various names. You know, we could as well be talking about Kali or Green Tara of Tibet or the Shulamite in the Hebrew Bible or the Queen of Sheba or Maria the Alchemist or Sarah the Egyptian or Lilith or ancient goddess figures such as Ishtar, Isis, Astarte, Cybele, or Sophia. But we're going to be talking about Mary Magdalene, and I will tell you why soon. In addition to what I have to say about her, there will be various kinds of amplification of our words, certainly our own internal responses, images, feelings, memories, bodily experiences, image in the form of slides and music. And I like to say a word about my use of music so that you understand the spirit in which I use it. I've had people say, well, we can't get CE credits for just listening to music. Well, let me tell you why you can and should. We in psychotherapy have done a great deal with listening in our consulting rooms, but we have not done much with the imagery and affect or feeling that is the spontaneous result of hearing music. The imagery that is somehow embedded in the music, that's what I found in the study that Connie mentioned. Despite the fact that music is utterly elemental to all of us, developmentally, in utero, we are literally floating in what are considered the four basic elements of sound: rhythm, melody, harmony, and timbre, or tone color. Tone color is the unique sound produced by any instrument, including my voice, as opposed to your voice, or your voice, or the oboe, or the trumpet, or whatever. Hearing is the first sense fully to develop. By 4.5 months of gestation, the hearing of the fetus is fully functional for hearing sounds internal to the mother, the voice, her heartbeat, all the other internal sounds with their rhythms, their melodic aspects, their harmonies, and their own timbres. And by 7 months of gestation, the fetus will startle at sounds external to the mother. After birth, it learns her voice before it learns her scent. And it may well be that, for those of you who are interested in object relations, there is a possibility that sound itself is the first object, the first thing outside ourselves that gives us the idea that somehow there's something outside of ourselves to which we can be related. In essence, tone is our first language because we understand tones long before we understand what the words mean. You know that. So the point here is that some of our deepest psychological understandings may come through music, which really is a parallel language. The music selections that we'll be hearing this weekend are all directly related to this topic. They're all presented in the spirit of the profound relationship between body, psyche, spirit, and music. While the music is playing, I invite you, if it feels comfortable, to try not to just listen intellectually, although you can certainly do that if you want to. But during the music, if it feels okay, allow yourself just to be in your own inner world and to bring the music in with you and see how the music speaks to you about whatever it is we're talking about. You may get other images, you may get feelings, thoughts, colors, kinesthetic experiences, whatever. Just let the music take you wherever you need to go. You may want to jot down a note or two about what your experience is. And this will be one more way that we can add to our understanding of the archetypal images and all the rest that we'll be talking about. Now, to further set the context for all this, I've been working on this material for years, but in the past couple of years, I've understood why, in a new way, I guess, why I at least feel it's terribly important that we undertake this study. One morning, a couple of years ago, I was pulled awake by a strange dreamlike experience that increasingly kind of dragged me into consciousness over, I would guess, 20 to 30 minutes. I do know I was fully awake by 6:20 West Coast time, and I immediately wrote the experience in my journal. It was this: a woman's voice, insistent, urgent, and aloud, speaking a couple sentences into my right ear. My right ear was literally resonating as though one of you in this room were speaking to me right now, but muffled and indistinct, as though she was speaking through the pillow that, in fact, my right ear was buried in. After an interval, the very same thing happened again. And this time, I roused enough to figure out if I could get my right ear out of the pillow. Maybe the next time I could hear what she was saying. But the experience wasn't repeated, so I never did hear the words. And I wrote it down. I continued to puzzle about it while sort of routinely preparing for the day until about 40 minutes later when the phone rang and a relative from the East Coast said, "Turn on the television." Well, of course, you probably know by now it was September 11th of 2001. And that was the end of anything routine about that day. But in the midst of trying to cope with and understand what had happened, I also was left trying to understand whether and how my own dreamlike experience was relevant to what had happened. And over time, I have come to the conviction that it was, that what happened on that day touched such a deep nerve in the collective psyche that up came a personal experience from the depths. Of course, it's relevant to me personally, but I have come to believe that there's also a larger relevance. And I want to tell you how I understand it and how it's relevant to this evening and tomorrow. The event that seems to have captured the most public or collective attention was the driven, massively aggressive act of crashing two hijacked airplanes containing kidnapped passengers and crew into the Twin Towers of the World Trade Center. Now, one way of thinking about that psychologically is on two axes, horizontal and vertical. On the horizontal, the thrusting, focused, unrelated, Aries-like aggression of the masculine archetypal principle of creativity, because it was a creative act, but gone horribly awry from our point of view, using technology for destructive purposes, intersecting with the perhaps inflated, given the height of the Twin Towers, but certainly thrusting vertical masculine creativity of the Twin Towers. So it's a conjunction of the masculine, but horrible one. I think that from deep within the world's soul, the feminine cried out insistently, maybe once for each tower, given the timing, but muffled and hidden as she so often is, cried out her pain for relatedness for Eros, not Aries. It came up in my own dream experience. I would have to wonder how many others. I think it's an example of what Jung called the self-regulating nature of the psyche, whether personal or collective. When one pole of an opposite is dominant in the individual or in the collective, the other will be building and will emerge when the time is right. Jung predicted in Ion that the present age would see a reemergence of the feminine principle. I think we are seeing it, and I think it becomes our opportunity and our obligation to develop this emerging consciousness. If you want to read more about the masculine and feminine principle, take a look at Gareth Hill's book called Masculine and Feminine. It's on your reading list. He's quite clear about all of this. We now understand more than ever, at least in recent years, what it means to have groups in power that repress anything connected with the feminine. An example from the San Francisco Chronicle a few months after 9/11 was a piece about Afghan women who had been forced to marry Al-Qaeda men who then deserted the women. One woman said, "He said he would kill me if he found out I had taken a picture, listened to music, or talked to a strange man." So I was blown away by that sentence. There it is, all in one sentence, the feminine, image, and music. That's just what we're doing tonight. I think and hope that in our own small way, we in this room have potential of holding the opposite of that aggressive masculine at its worst attitude by being in and with the feminine and image and music. So, with all that as sort of leading up to it, let's take a giant step backward in time to ancient Greece. Originally in Greece, it was the Muse herself who was worshipped on the mountaintops. Robert Graves wrote a wonderful essay called Intimations of the Black Goddess. He wrote it in about 63 or 65. And he says the black goddess was in fact the age-old matriarchal triple goddess who ruled sky, earth, and underworld. She was the goddess of all. That was one of her titles. This is a title that's also applied to Isis and to Mary Magdalene. The goddess of all was worshipped in ecstatic mountaintop rituals in which a male dancer would invoke the muse by he would improvise hexameter verses to the accompaniment of the lyre, and he would say, "Sing muse," which meant enter into one of these women dancers and speak through her. It was sing to us through her mouth, which is, seems to me like almost a mandate that we, like they, include music. So this next piece is a hymn to the muse. It is Greek. We don't really know what Greek music sounded like, but there's some pretty good scholarship, and I think this is an example of it. This is less than a minute long, so I have it on the tape twice so you get a chance to really see what it's like. Extraordinary how simple sounding and direct and earnest it sounds, and always grounded by that drone going along underneath. But before the 8th century BCE, the cult of the muse was transferred to Apollo, and Graves, at the time he wrote this, thought that the muse never again spoke directly and spontaneously through a woman worshiper. The oracles of Apollo did chant through women, but these women were in service to Apollo, not the muse. Other than that, ecstatic experiences were forced underground. The black goddess is forced underground. So how does she and how do we feel about that? Mozart expresses it for us in one way as he writes for and about the black goddess in the Magic Flute. The black goddess in Magic Flute is the queen of the night, who was depicted as is part of the pattern of this image as a villainess. She needs to be vanquished. She's angry. Her kingdom, including its temple of wisdom, has been usurped by the male god Zoroaster. The first ritual of initiation into his temple is the renunciation of women, or the feminine. And she's angry because her daughter has been stolen. Part of the feminine, or the future of the feminine, has been stolen and has either sold out or been sold out to Zoroaster's religion, or the dominance of the masculine. So the Queen of the Night sings her famous and extremely difficult vengeance aria, demanding that her daughter kill Zoroaster, kill the dominance of the masculine. The words roughly translate as "the vengeance of hell is boiling in my heart," and you can really feel that in the aria, both in the accompaniment and in the vocal line. It's very controlled, yes it is Mozart, but it outrageously transcends what is normal vocal expression. So it seems appropriate to hear her now with her feelings of being enraged and having been driven underground. Someone described that as elegant fury. It's like kind of Feeler saying, take that and furthermore. At the end of the opera, Strength, beauty, and wisdom have triumphed, but wisdom, the black, the feminine, has been driven underground yet again. The split is perpetuated. The dark is renounced, and only the sun god, the light, the masculine, is to be honored in the initiatory rites of Isis and Osiris. But I think this is a misunderstanding by either Mozart or his librettist, and it may be a bit of cheek for me to say that, but still, I think it is. The truth is, Isis was often pictured as dark, and she carried both the light and the dark, not just the light. She was representative not of the split, but more of wholeness. It has seemed to me that perhaps the ecstatic voice of this muse, the dark goddess, was not directly heard again until she spoke through the voice and extraordinary music of a 12th century woman, the great Hildegard of Bingen. I think Graves just didn't know about Hildegard. Hildegard is, in this next piece, writing directly in praise of wisdom or Sophia or Sapientia herself. It's called O Virtus Sapientiae. It's written in the D mode. The modes, Greek modes, were sort of roughly the predecessors of our scales and key signatures. The D mode was considered to be the source and origin of all other modes, as Sophia or Sapientia is the source and origin of all. So the words here are, you power of wisdom that circling and embracing all in a course that is filled with life, you have three wings, one soars into the heights, another has moisture from the earth, the third flies all around, all praise to you, wisdom, as is your due. That of that is kind of rock solid, centered, ecstatic tension of that for the opposites. So it talks about circling. Well, how feminine. around a central point. In the music, it was the drone or pedal point. And circling, as we're going to be doing in this material, around a central point, like walking a labyrinth. And certainly circling, as I have done in exploring this material, essentially just going where the trail of the labyrinth led me next. It's slippery material, it's feminine, and it's non-linear, and it spans the whole range between concrete and symbolic. I've tried to straighten it out just enough so that I hope it will be comprehensible. Now, I've been mentioning wisdom connected with Mozart and Hildegard, and I want to put this in context. In Graves' essay on the Black Goddess, he writes, "At Hierapolis, Jerusalem, and Rome, the white goddess acknowledged a mysterious sister, the goddess of wisdom, whose temple was small and unthronged. Call her the Black Goddess. Provençal and Sicilian black virgins are so named because they derive from an ancient tradition of wisdom as blackness." Wisdom as blackness. This black goddess represents a miraculous certitude in love. The goddess Night appeared in Triad as blackness, namely wisdom, order, and justice. She was known as an oracle. The goddess Night was regarded as a positive power, not as mere absence of daylight. And black was known as a prime color, not as absence of color, and it was prized more than any other. How many of us are wearing black in here tonight? I'm suddenly noticing. The black goddess, this is Graves again, is so far hardly more than a whispered word of hope. She promises a new pacific bond between men and women, corresponding to a final reality of love. The black goddess has experienced good and evil, love and hate, truth and falsehood, but chooses what is good. She will lead us back to that sure instinct of love which we long ago forfeited by intellectual pride. In other words, she experiences the opposite. She has really lived, but she doesn't get polarized. And second, we went too much into our heads with our intellectual pride. Well, what may have been whispers when Graves wrote this in the early 60s have certainly grown louder. You only have to take a look at the reading list I've provided with you. Even when I began to study the Magdalene in 1985, there were really only a few references on her, and now it's hard to keep up with all that's coming out. Scholarly work, novels, everything else. The latest is The Gospel of Mary of Magdala by Karen King, who's a Harvard feminist theologian, which I'm sort of digging up into and was having fun with on the plane on the way up here. I'll talk more about that later. So scholarly work, novels, and so on. One of the most recent is The Da Vinci Code. How many of you have read The Da Vinci Code? Compelling, fairly well-researched mystery novel on the current bestseller list. I think it's number one still. And then in early November, ABC News did a special, extraordinary, based on the questions raised in this book. Also, there have been articles in Time, Newsweek, the Christian Science Monitor, the New York Times, the San Francisco Chronicle, and who knows what else. What is going on? I think maybe the dark goddess wants to be heard, wants to offer her unique feminine and spiritual qualities to the world in compensation for the Aries aggression found readily in both women and men. And that is why this novel is so popular. The idea, the collective psyche, I think, was ready for it and is calling for a kind of a balance. Now, as I said earlier, we could, of course, approach the archetype of the dark feminine from any angle, but Mary Magdalene was the entree literally presented to me. And I think through her story, myth, legend, all of it, we find the qualities of the dark feminine. My own journey with this image began with a dream I had in response to a question that I heard in 1985. The question was, you have 30 minutes to spend talking with a living, historical, or fictional person. With whom would you spend that time? Why? And what did you discuss? I'll repeat it. You have 30 minutes to spend talking with a living, historical, or fictional person. With whom would you spend that time? Why? And what would you discuss? I would love to take credit for thinking up that question. But the fact is, it's a wonderful projective question. It was one of the admissions essays on my daughter's college application in 1985. Initially, I suppose, as most mothers, I was quite interested in who she would choose and vaguely thought of who I would choose. And a couple of names occurred to me, Bach, Jung, but nothing really grabbed me. But then a couple of weeks later, I had a dream of a double wedding, and the name of one of the brides was Magdalene. Only then did I become fully aware that since I'd heard the question, the name Mary Magdalene had been unaccountably popping into my head, and I'd been sort of mentally brushing it away, saying, go away, I don't know what this is about, if even that much. But now I could no longer do so. So it seemed to be a message from the unconscious, pay attention to Mary Magdalene. Something about her wanted to be recognized. And so the dialogue has been going on not for that half hour, but for nearly 19 years. And I tell you this partly because people always say, well, how did you get interested in this? But also, maybe more than that, is that I think maybe in each of our lifetimes, there's only a handful of images that gets this compelling. And so my hope for each one of you is that you either have had, are having, or will have your own experience of feeling that you have to get related to this, some kind of energy that presents itself to you. Initially, at the time this all came up, I knew very little about her. It's really the standard stuff. I was raised mainline Protestant, so I knew that she was associated with Jesus, especially at the crucifixion, and was there at the tomb on Easter morning. I knew that wasn't she the one that was supposed to be the reformed prostitute? Not much. And then, of course, comes the disquieting questions, what does she want with me? Almost immediately, a series of synchronicities began, which soon as I kind of consciously took up the project, combined with active exploration, which continues to this day, through the biblical and historically relevant material, the tradition of Mary Magdalene, through ancient papyrus material, such as the Nag Hammadi text and the Gospel of Mary herself, which flows into the legends about Mary Magdalene and which also flows into the Black Madonnas, exploring the alternative history, remembering that history is written by the winners, and so what's the other part of that? There's a lot about that. It to our lives and to clinical material and that sort of thing. For as scant in a way as the material is, we can really learn a lot. And I have to say I'm very indebted to the wonderful scholarship that's happening with this material. And then, of course, there's our own experience of her. Now, before I get into describing her, I have a little sidebar. Instead of using the name Jesus, I will use, except when I'm quoting, the more historically accurate Hebrew name Yeshua, which is used more frequently these days. I use it because I think it helps us take a step backward into more objectivity about the material because it's less loaded. So I'm really not talking about Christianity or, for that matter, religion or the politics of feminism, although in a way they are all here. But what I'm trying to do is to speak psychologically. And of course, these stories are relevant because they touch something so deep in all of us. And as a Jungian analyst and a musician, what interests me is what is the meaning of her emergence? How come all these books now? How is it relevant to us today? And how can music and art add to our understanding? So it's 8:30. How about we hear just a little bit more about her in sort of official thought? Is that okay, or do you need a break right now? Keep going? Okay, keep going. All right. So she appears in the adult years of Yeshua. These were the years of preaching and teaching. There may have only been 1 to 3 of those years. Most powerfully, she appears at the resurrection, but I think that she's both prefigured and split off at the birth of the divine child. Prefigured in two ways. One, we commonly say Yeshua was born under a particular star. We don't know whether it's a comet or a supernova or what, but we call it a star. The stars were born under our thought to influence who we are and what we do in life. The star happens to be a heavenly attribute of all the heavenly goddesses. Ishtar, Astarte, Mary Magdalene is a later manifestation of them. Second, I think that she's prefigured in that one of the main gifts of the divine child is myrrh, which is used for healing and anointing and embalming. We have the slide projector on, please. And this is a slide of the Magdalene. It's on the leg of an old altar table at Saint-Maximin Basilica in France. She's holding her alabaster jar. Alabaster is known as the queen of stones, interestingly. This jar always is said to contain myrrh, or precious ointment, and she may be well the woman who pours it over Yeshua's head, anointing him as king in Matthew. But she's split off because with the decision made at the Council of Ephesus in 431 that the Virgin Mary is the Mother of God, the so-called feminine becomes pure, spotless, sinless, only light, and so-called good. And that is at the expense of the earthy, thonic, human, sexual, living, womanly feminine, which gets relegated to the shadow. And there it pretty much has remained for 2,000 years. In art imagery, Mary Magdalene is also sometimes shown covered only with lots of hair, as in this slide and this one by Titian. This is La Maddalena. The hair is said to symbolize her penitence for her sins, but on the other hand, wearing her hair unbound is also said to have symbolized her looseness. Luke is the only one of the four Gospels in the Christian Bible to name Mary Magdalene as the woman from whom Yeshua casts out seven devils or evils. That is also found at the end of Mark, but contemporary scholarship has told us that that is an added-on piece to make it consistent with Luke. Usually, however, she's shown in red to distinguish her from the Virgin Mary, as in this painting by Botticelli. Can you all see sort of around or through me or something? Now, why is she shown in red? Well, this is because the art censor for the medieval Inquisition in 1649 decreed that the Virgin Mary should never be shown in red, but only in blue and or white, so she wouldn't be confused with Mary Magdalene, leaving the Magdalene to be shown in red, which has become the color of the fallen woman, as in red light districts. But red is also the color of the real flesh and blood woman. Red is the color of feeling and passion, of blood, the life force. It's the color of the libido, the life-giving principle. And this is a trait that she shares with Isis, who is also often shown in red. In the Christian Bible, Mary Magdalene is named in all four Gospels at the site of the crucifixion, the burial, and the resurrection. Principally, it's at that point that we learn that a number of women had been followers, which actually meant that they were disciples, since the beginning of Yeshua's ministry in Galilee, which was probably the home district of both Magdalene and Yeshua. We learn that these women ministered to him of their substance, which meant it was these women who provided the financial support for the ministry. Magdalene is usually referred to as being quite wealthy, either of a wealthy family or wealthy because of her activities as a prostitute. But I think that you'll see that symbolically she had a great deal of inner wealth. That she is mentioned with only one exception at the time of the crucifixion suggests that her role in the movement was so important that perhaps she could not be omitted any longer. It's Magdalene who, with the other women and only the women, is at the scene of the crucifixion within speaking distance. The male disciples have all fled for their lives into hiding because, after all, anybody associated with this guy would have been in trouble. We have some music that goes with this by Frescobaldi, who lived around the same time as Botticelli. It's called Magdalene at the Cross, and I think of it as kind of her own passion. The words are, at the foot of the great cross where languished close to death the God Jesus expiring, all disheveled was heard thus to cry the faithful grieving lover. Never since life was life were received from India or the Atlas pearls or gold more beautiful than the tears of her fair eyes or the gold of her waving outspread tresses. Alas, how can you, she said, O my Lord, live the last moment without me? How, if you die, can I live? And if in truth you will die, my soul being united with you, you know it, my Redeemer, my God, I must therefore share both death and life with you. See what I mean when I think of it as her passion. With the crucifixion, the world of the Magdalene has been plunged into Advent-like darkness and despair. Interesting thing about this picture by Savoldo in the 16th century, it's now on the covers of at least four books that I could probably name for you. This is a big one. I'm particularly taken by the expression in her eyes, her sort of doubled overness and the expression. Of course, this is painted before the Inquisition, so she can be in white. Composer Hugo Wolf wrote a stunning piece called Das verlassene Mägdlein, The Forsaken Maiden. It's about a servant girl abandoned by her love and utterly lost in grief. It begins with a cock crowing, which is a strong allusion to the Christian story, and the depth of sadness is connected to Mary Magdalene. It's really about profound emotional expression, extraordinary grief. It makes me think of Magdalene at just this time between the crucifixion and the resurrection. So let me play it for you quickly. You can really feel the depth of that grief and profound resignation. I'll do one more slide and talk about it, and then we'll have a 10-minute break. Then with the resurrection, hope is reborn, as it was first born with the divine child. Surely it's significant that Mary Magdalene, a woman, is the first witness to the resurrection, the spiritual birth, that she has her own direct experience, which was probably a visionary experience. Jung says this in volume 18, and some of the current theological scholars are beginning to say this was probably a visionary experience. It's her own unshakable inner knowing of what was happening. You recall the story, she's been grieving at the tomb, and all the more so because now the body has disappeared. She wanted to anoint it for burial. And she sees a man she thinks is the gardener. Interestingly, Titian originally painted this with a gardener's hat on Yeshua. And decided to thought the better of it, I guess. And she says, you know, what have you done with the body? I just want to anoint it. This was, you know, the person I loved. And she begs them to tell her where it is. And only when the gardener calls her by name, calls her Mary, only when she hears, does she realize this man is a manifestation of the resurrected Yeshua. She turns and calls him by his intimate or familiar name. His title is Rabbi. She calls him Rabbuni, which means Master, my Lord, my Great One, all in the sense of my scholar or my teacher. So she is the first to have this direct experience of someone in another dimension, a gnosis. He tells her, noli me tangere, that's the Latin for the title of this picture, which means touch me not, but to go and tell the others. And this is the earliest source for her being called apostola apostolorum, that is, apostle to the apostles, although it's more correctly, I understand, the new scholarship says it's more correctly translated as apostle of apostles, meaning the greatest of all apostles, as the Song of Songs is the greatest of all songs. Now, I'm not going to play it because for lack of time, but you have the particular recording on your discography. Musically, this event is best illustrated by the song that's at the beginning, the aria that's at the beginning of the third part of Handel's Messiah, I Know That My Redeemer Liveth. The meaning is scored right into the music. I know that my Redeemer liveth. If you could pick up a copy of this by the Berkeley Philharmonia with Lorraine Hunt, now Lorraine Hunt Lieberson, singing it, listen to what she does with it, and you will have a new experience of this piece, even if you've heard it, you know, hundreds of times. It is really, I've come to think of it as Mary Magdalene's piece. If you had to assign a character to sing it, it could only be her because of its placement in the work. And I think of it as her awe-stricken, ecstatic, contemplative experience of gnosis, her own visionary experience. She says, yet in my flesh shall I see God. And so so pick that up sometime if you can, and if we have time tomorrow, I'll run it through for you. Let's take a 10-minute break, and please be back. I still have a bunch to cover. Thank you. See many of you tomorrow. We really get much more. I think of tonight as we kind of drop the pebble into the water, and then tomorrow we feel it radiating out. Somebody came up and asked about the trip to Provence. If you're interested in that, I'll stay around for a few minutes afterwards. We do go. We do visit some of these sites. We do talk about this material at leisure because we have a whole week to do it in. So if you're interested at all, I have a piece of paper here. You can sign up and let me know how to reach you because I'll be sending letters out very soon about that. Okay, so what we've heard so far are the only references to Mary Magdalene by name in the Christian Bible. However, she's long associated with or conflated with four other incidents in that text. First, she's thought to be the bride at the wedding at Cana, where Yeshua turns water into wine. Second, she's thought to be the woman who's about to be stoned when he intervenes and says, "Let him who is without sin among you cast the first stone," that is, look at your own shadow first. He intervenes, and this is a theme we find a great deal. He intervenes on her behalf. She gets it, she understands, the others don't. She's thought to be identical with Mary of Bethany. This is the Mary of the Mary and Martha story. You know, Yeshua shows up at their house, he sits down, Mary sits down right at his feet. She wants to hear the spiritual message. You can imagine Martha in the kitchen getting the food ready, getting increasingly envious and jealous and maybe starting to slam around a little bit, and pretty soon she comes in and says, "Look, shouldn't she be in here with me, you know, helping me fix the food?" And he says, "Mm-mm, she's chosen the better part." He intervenes again because she knows what she's doing. And finally, it is she probably, or at least it's thought to be, she who washed Yeshua's feet with precious ointment and her hair and anointed him, incurring the wrath of the other disciples who thought it was wasteful. They said, you know, how come we could sell this ointment and make money to give to the poor? And Yeshua says, yeah, well, you'll always have the poor around, but I'm about to die, and she knows what she's doing. She's anointing me both as king and for my death. And furthermore, for her doing so, she will be remembered as long as this story is told. We'll have a wonderful piece of music about that, the last thing tomorrow. Only he and she seem to understand what she has independently decided to do. It has to be explained to the others, and this is a real theme, both in the Christian Bible and especially in the Gnostic texts. He intervenes on her behalf or on behalf of the feminine. So the legend so far tells us a great deal. This is a woman who chooses the spiritual. She is saved from collective opinions. She acts from her own inner authority and is not always understood, but for which she is always to be recognized. And she knew she experienced some kind of miraculous visionary event. It also tells us she's important. Wherever she's mentioned in the Christian Bible, she is always, with only one exception, put first in the list of women who are, you know, when several women are mentioned, she is always first. This certainly underscores her importance. We know that she suffered. This is a particularly interesting part of it. She was healed of seven something or other. The many things that I've seen proposed are really quite wonderful. Was it seven devils, seven evils, prostitution, the seven deadly sins, illness, something psychosomatic? One author is absolutely convinced it was something psychosomatic. Something about the chakras needing correcting. They were understood at the time. Something about the soul, which in Hellenistic thought had eight parts, so seven of them were corrupted somehow. A medieval chant suggests she didn't know how to love. As a Jungian analyst, I might throw in, maybe she's healed of her own complexes. Makes some sense to me. Whatever it was, she was transformed, and therefore the emphasis on her as sinner is not completely accurate. Rather, she's a woman who was into some kind of trouble, experienced a transformative power, a transformation, and acceptance. She doesn't shrink in the face of great grief and horrible death. She experiences fully. She witnesses. She's chief witness. Imagining witnessing the death by torture of somebody you love. So she's an image of suffering, of transformation, of allowing the full experience of her feelings, and of persistence. And furthermore, she's a model of tolerating anxiety, because discipleship or following would have meant abandoning home, family, property, whatever security you had, and would have put the disciple in danger, both from the Jews because of betrayal of them and the Romans because Yeshua is wanted for insurrection, which is a crime against the Roman Empire. So we have a woman here with the ability to tolerate the the implications of doing something very unconventional in order to follow her own deep beliefs. This begins to emerge as rather a role model, I think. And then what can her name tell us? She's always called some variant of Mary of Magdala. Magdala, or I think it's called Migdal now, is generally thought to be the Hebrew name of the town that she is from, which implies that she's a Jewish woman, since the town also has a Greek name, Tarakia. But so that implies that there was a lot of Hellenistic thought there, but there was a lot more there. It seems likely to me that the Magdalene, like the San Franciscan or the Parisian or the New Yorker, would imply something of her city's characteristics, which in this case were both piety and so-called adultery, both Jewish and Hellenistic culture, international trading, because it's on several international trade routes, with all that that would imply, different languages, different cultures, different customs, and also a prosperity that at the time of her life was suffering under Roman domination. So then violence and political upheaval would be all a part of her. The word Magdala means tower, so Magdalene means she of the tower. I think she begins to emerge as a towering figure of inner strength. And what about her first name, Mary? A name so common to us that we might not even think about it. I'm going to say a little bit more about it tomorrow with a piece of music. But it was a common Hebrew name for women at that time, said to go back to Miriam the prophetess in Exodus, the sister of Moses and Aaron. Often the name Mary is associated with la mère, the sea in French, or la mère, the mother in French. But literally from the Aramaic, Mariam, do you know what it means? It means rebellion. And that always does get some interest. And I thought, wow, what do I do with this? And it seems to me that both Marys, both of the famous Marys, might well have seemed rebellious or at least unconventional by their society. One gets pregnant before marriage and claims no man is involved. And the other gives up either prostitution or a wealthy life to follow this rebel itinerant preacher who's wanted for insurrection. Maybe it is that Mary is just the name given to these two feminine figures to imply something of the nature of their character. So this pretty much summarizes what we can learn from what we know so far of Western biblical thought. But fortunately, we have other sources, especially very hidden sources, hidden for a very long time, the ancient papyrus texts, in which Mary Magdalene, by name, plays a much fuller, much more important role than she does in the Christian Bible. In several of these texts, she has a prominent role as disciple, leader, visionary, messenger of the esoteric revelations. She is consistently praised by Yeshua for understanding completely his message, in essence being on the same wavelength with him. She got it, while the others seemed pretty much consistently to need to have it explained to them, and sometimes didn't get it, as when she anointed him, for example, or refused to believe it. Current theological scholarship by a very well-known Harvard feminist theologian, Elizabeth Schuster-Fiorenza, suggests that Yeshua's religion was actually a wisdom or Sophia religion. And maybe that suggests why the Magdalene was so on the same wavelength with him. She is consistently named as the disciple who's closest of all to Yeshua, the one who is the one who is the recipient of the mystical traditions and teachings from him, teachings either did not tell the others, or they forgot, or they didn't understand. One book rather irreverently said the rest of the disciples were really rather dim sometimes. She is, in fact, the leader of the so-called Gnostics, perhaps giving rise to the suggestion that she was the original pope. Think of La Papessa card in the tarot. So where does that come from? Talk more about that tomorrow. In at least four of the texts, Peter and the others are jealous of her. There's a great rivalry that goes on with her. in the text called Pista Sophia, which means faith, wisdom, which is the longest of the Nag Hammadi texts, Peter complains that Mary Magdalene is dominating the conversation and wants Yeshua to shut her up. Later, Magdalene says to Yeshua, quote, "Peter makes me hesitate. I am afraid of him because he hates the female race." In the Gospel of Philip, we hear, "There were three who always walked with the Lord, Mary his mother and his sister and Magdalene, the one who was called his companion. His sister and his mother and his companion were each a Mary." And a little bit later in the same text, "And the companion of the Savior is Mary Magdalene. But Christ loved her more than all the disciples and used to kiss her often on the mouth. The rest of the disciples were offended by it and expressed disapproval. They said to him, 'Why do you love her more than all of us?' The Savior answered and said to them, 'Why do I not love you like her?'" So we'll come back to the rivalry in a moment, but first the kiss, or kisses. They may have been spiritual or mystical kisses, which was the tradition of the time. Much as in Christian churches today, the peace is exchanged. This would be the kiss of peace. Erotic love has often been used to express mystical experiences, as in the Song of Songs. But there's actual jealousy here, and that may imply that she really was more than just a devotee. It is quite possible that she was Yeshua's partner or companion. This would be logical. He was a rabbi. Rabbis have always been expected to be married. And it would have been noteworthy, probably, had he not been married. But his marital status really is never mentioned. And the Greek word used here, koinonos, is often translated as companion, but I understand that it is more correctly translated as partner or consort and implies a sexual relationship. That's from Susan Haskins, who's really written quite a scholarly book on Mary Magdalene. The rivalry is also in the Gospel of Mary, which was written maybe as early as 90 CE, but more likely in the second century, so it's very early material. There have been only a few fragments of it found. Half of it is missing. The fragments are only this large. These are life-size. They're only about 4 by 5 inches. It's just stunning, and this is such an important text. It's short, half of it's missing, but probably was sufficiently worth reading that it's both in Greek and Coptic, and not only Coptic, but the language of the ordinary Egyptian. In general, in this work, she teaches the others, she embraces them, she encourages them when they're feeling scared after the crucifixion, she weeps when she's not believed, and she stops talking when she has no more to say. So she has strong feelings, she has action, she has a lot of influence. She's a guide, she's able to direct them inward. The Gospel of Mary itself pulls the reader inward. She has the gift of helping them seek the anthropos, which Jung would translate as the self. Here we come to a problem, and that is the translations of this text. There are 4 or 5 of them that I have, 4 I guess. And they're very similar, but very different in very crucial places, like the word anthropos, which gets variously translated as the human one, the son of man, the child of truth, humanity, the image of the divine realm. So if anybody knows a Greek Coptic scholar, I want somebody who can give me my own translation that would work in a psychological context. Anybody know anybody like that? Let me know. She questions Yeshua. She takes on the role of chief questioner about the nature of matter, the importance of and survival of matter. She questions him about the sin of the world. She questions about the nature of illness. Actually, Peter, I think, questions about that. And the importance of what is within oneself. Some of the answers are that it's important that we find our own inner nature, that there is no sin, but you make sin exist when you act according to the habits of your corrupted nature. Yeshua says the real answers are within, and that's where we should go to find them. Does this sound familiar? how like Jung's ideas, that our own nature may get adulterated. Adultery is the word used in some of the translations, but that just means something that the original has been corrupted. But the point is not to get polarized by our life experiences. He says, don't look here and don't look there. Look inside. So the nature of the work in life is to restore us to what we were really meant to be, to redeem our true nature. We call it individuation in our context. Mary says she saw Yeshua in a vision, and he praised her for not being shaken by that experience, because the real treasure is that part of the mind that can perceive or apprehend in that visionary way, to apprehend the inner images. Yeshua is very clear that this quality or ability to see the inner image is the real treasure. I love it. How like Jung, who quotes Ruland in saying, imagination is the star in man, the celestial or super-celestial body. It's all right there. Peter then acknowledges that Yeshua loves Mary Magdalene the most and told her more than he told them. He asks her to teach them. At his request, she describes stages toward the goal. Unfortunately, there's a 4-page interruption in there, and we pick up sort of in the middle of it. Perhaps she is describing the 7 evils from which she was liberated, but most certainly she is describing the shadow, stages with things like jealousy, lethal jealousy, anger, craving, inflation, all those things, of course, that we'd rather not know about in ourselves. And she says that his teaching is that only when one or the soul has successfully dealt with these shadowy elements and complexes, she doesn't use that word, only then can we hope to reach the goal, which is called silence with a capital S, or a kind of inner peace, usually understood as contemplation or wisdom itself, with capital W, in which one can be guided by something more eternal than only ego concerns, as important as they may be sometimes. Maybe this is where the legend comes from, that she was a contemplative in Provence for 30 years, and we go to that site. But now Peter refuses to believe her, and the rivalry breaks out again. Having asked her to speak, he now doesn't like or believe what he hears. Mary cries and asks if he thinks she could make all this up, but Levi intervenes and says, Peter, you've always had a hot temper. Now quit arguing with her like she was one of the adversaries. So this whole thing is very, very revealing about Peter caught by his complex, Mary, both her strength and her vulnerability, her real humanness. She cries when she's not believed. And probably contains the seeds of the Gnostics being declared heretics once Peter's church in Rome is politicized and takes over. So in very brief summary, she in the Gnostic Gospel is represented as being with knowledge, wisdom, and insight far exceeding that of Peter and the other disciples. She's described in a couple places as inheritor of the light, perhaps implying that she is to succeed Yeshua. She's also called the spirit of wisdom and the woman who knew the all. And she alone, is the carrier of the mystical or esoteric teachings. And she is, again, linked directly with the idea of black through the whole Sophia idea. And that has to do with the prima materia, which is black. But then the question arises, why would wisdom be portrayed as a whore, which is, after all, the reputation that the Magdalene had for 2,000 years until 1969, when the Catholic Church officially rescinded the idea that she was a prostitute, but, you know, it's still out there. Maybe it is that the Church Fathers simply couldn't have wisdom being associated with an actual flesh and blood woman, that is, with matter, which they tried so hard to repress. Another interpretation that Ian Begg gives, Ian Begg's an Irish Jungian analyst, that the idea of wisdom as a whore is parallel to the actual whore. She's there for all who want her, but you have to look sometimes really hard to find where she is. The fact is, in Eastern Orthodox tradition, Mary Magdalene has never been portrayed as a whore, but only as the carrier of the valuable healing ointment. It was Pope Gregory in 591 who declared that she was a prostitute. But the word for prostitute, the Greek word for prostitute, porine, is never used in any of these texts. The word that is used, the Greek word, is harmartolos, which just means sinner, which could be any kind of a sinner and not specifically a prostitute. Well, how come the legend then? And I think for our understanding, what it represents, what it symbolizes, is how we've all sold out individually, women as a group, men selling out the feminine sides of themselves, and the culture repressing the feminine. I'm going to go quickly on into legend in the hopes of finishing in a few minutes. The Magdalene is directly connected with the Black Madonna, dark goddess tradition. How do we know this? Well, it's well known that there's often been a cult of Mary Magdalene and the Black Madonna at the same place. Some of the Black Madonnas are directly associated with Mary Magdalene. They're in or near a church named for the Magdalene, or they're meant to represent her. And then there's the whole associative path of her as an image of Sophia or wisdom, and wisdom is blackness. Why are they black? The church fathers, as you've heard, generally want to dismiss them totally, but if pressed, sometimes they'll say they're black, well, because it's dirt or candle smoke. Now, this is very unlikely, because then why wouldn't the other statues be black in the same church? Some are known to have been designed as black. Some may have begun as Celtic fertility idols. Some are associated with countries where skin color is dark. Others may have been brought back as trophies from the Crusades, but then they're simply a continuation under this new religion of the ancient goddesses and what they were all about. Some of them, if we could have the slide projector, and now I've lost it, if somebody could hand me that. Some of them have only a black hand or foot, and they may not be black at all, but nevertheless, by tradition, they're considered to be Black Madonnas. Is that on? Because of their powers. This beautiful one at Orcival in the Auvergne region of France is not black at all, but she is a very powerful, considered to be a very powerful Black Madonna. We'll see a little bit more of her tomorrow. This is one that we always love to see in Aix-en-Provence. She came there from Italy, apparently, and the thing is about her black hand. Very interesting. She's really quite beautiful, and you'll see her tomorrow more in her context. The church fathers may want to dismiss them, but they keep them around because they say the public wants them. And I could tell you from my own experience as well as my observation that wherever they are very often centers of intense energy and devotion and sometimes very powerful inner experiences. They seem to understand with the heart. This one is called the Heart of Bavaria, and she's one of the few that I've seen who's actually gazing at her child. She's quite lovely. We'll see a little bit more about her tomorrow. Or this one at Einsiedeln, about 45 minutes from Zurich, which Jung and von Franz both associate with Isis. You can't see it here, but in her little chapel, and we'll see much more of her tomorrow, hearts are overhead, and off her scepter are often hanging hearts. We'll also see her as she really is, without all the elaborate gowns. I think we can turn that off now. The church fathers may want to dismiss them, yet they keep them around. I said that because the public wants them. These little, and they are little, they're from about a foot high to 4 feet high, is about the biggest I know of. They're symbolic of an elemental and uncontrollable source of life. They carry a spirit and wisdom all their own, not necessarily subject to the organization or laws of rationality. They're not really in any service to any outer authority. They're kind of about the non-rational, which of course has its own rationale. Well, what about the blackness? Alchemically, it's the color of the negredo, the prima materia. It's the shadow, it's the dunghill, and that's where we find the gold. It's connected with the fertility of earth. These are fertility goddesses and caves, or the darkness of the womb and creativity, or something that's been burned and transformed through the burning, a fiery initiation. It's also, of course, connected with despair and depression and death and mourning. It's connected with the dark side of the moon or the cool darkness of a church or chapel, which is where we find many of them. And it's about wisdom, black but beautiful, wise but beautiful, like the Shulamite in the Song of Songs. That's where we get the phrase, I am black but beautiful. And we'll have three pieces of music tomorrow that will have to do with that and talk more about her. So, in conclusion, hidden in the tradition of the black but beautiful Madonnas, and especially in the darkness of the unconscious, is really a great spiritual leader to us all. She plunges us down through thousands of years back to the origins of the universe, and down through thousands of layers of the psyche to the long repressed, hidden, or black but beautiful, supremely feminine parts of ourselves. Who knows where they come from? We may never know. But in France, I met a French man. He's a photographer whose passion is photographing in minute detail every detail of the Basilica in Saint-Maximin, where that altar table is that I showed you first. Every detail. That place is supposed to be Mary Magdalene's burial place. You could go there and see her tomb. We'll talk more about that tomorrow, too. He's immersed in the tradition of Magdalene and the Black Madonnas. But I think he knew nothing about Jung. And so when the group that I was with at the time started saying, well, but where are they from? Africa, India, or what? He said to me very matter-of-factly, well, it doesn't matter where she came from. We over here all know she's in here. And I think, you know, whether we visit these sites or not, this is in here is where we have to look for her. Thank you.
And that is the end of the tape. Copyright CG Jung Society, Seattle, and the speaker. All rights reserved. No copying, please.